So there's something about that song that appeals both to our bodies and our brains. Apparently the evidence is in the fact, I suppose, that on YouTube alone it's been viewed by more than a billion people. And its speed, 120 beats per minute. We'll find out about the speed of songs, how they can synchronize our minds and our bodies. We're about to be introduced to something called a groove machine, which it's claimed can make people more willing to get on with one another. How hypermobile people may be susceptible to mental frailty is interesting. How core strength is linked to stress control, the emotional benefits of being strong and having good posture. All that and quite a bit more to be discussed with science writer Caroline Wilson, who's kicking off this hour for us. She writes for The Guardian and the BBC. She's authored a book on the brain called Override, and Caroline is also the editor of two new scientist guides, How Your Brain Works and Your Conscious Mind. Her new book is Move, The New Science of Body Over Mind. Caroline Williams, hello.
Hello.
Your book starts with your reluctant excursion to a local hall in Surrey at 7:30 on a cold night, I think it was a cold night, for a session of mind-altering free-form dance, and you enter the hall with trepidation and a certain disdain for what you're seeing. And then what happens, please, Caroline?
Well, yes, I mean, I'm definitely in the bracket of people who only dance like no one's watching when nobody actually is watching. So I signed up to this. I'd heard a lot about it through a friend of a friend, that it's like this spiritual experience and you just move your body in particular ways, and you know, and I was thinking, oh my goodness, this is really not for me. But I'm going to do it. In the interest of research, I'm going to go. So I refused all offers of friends to come with me because I thought it'd be too embarrassing. So I went on my own, and I sort of turned up at the door, and the nice young man said, come in and move however your body wants to. And it was just painful. I sort of held onto the radiator by the side of the room for ages, going, oh, this is awful. But, you know, and it took a long time to warm up. There was lots of sort of following your hand around and wafting around and, you know, all kinds of stuff. But by the end of it, this sort of the music built up this kind of crescendo, and there was a point at which there was a DJ behind the decks who was there with his harem pants on and his bleached hair and everything, looking really cool, and he just murmured into the mic, he just said, let go. And it was almost like he was talking to me, and I just kind of went for it, and I just went along with the beat, and it just felt like I was no longer in control of my legs. My legs was kind of hammering around and my arms were flying and my head was going all over the place. I could barely move my neck for days because I was shaking my head so much. And I was completely free and flying, and I was on a complete high for days afterwards. It was quite impressive, really. Really not what I was expecting on a Wednesday night in Surrey.
It's quite impressive reading in the book, and you become a convert of sorts to dance. So we'll get back to dance. In terms of the general value of your book, we move around 30% less than our counterparts in the 1960s. You tell us that children spend up to 50% of their free time sitting around. The elderly are especially afflicted, spending up to 80% of their waking days barely moving a muscle. So, Caroline, we're becoming like the characters in the Wall-E movie, which was on our TV recently, actually. They're all fat and they can't do things for themselves and they lack any initiative. Modern society, not to be too harsh, is kind of morphing into a version of that.
We definitely have got to a state in our sort of society where we don't have to move. It's a voluntary thing. So, you know, if you wanted to sit around moving your fingers and thumbs, you know, you can definitely get your shopping delivered to your door. You can date, you know, at least find someone to go on a date with. You can earn a living. You could do pretty much everything without moving if you really want to, which is all well and good. And I mean, I know you've had it easier, I think, in New Zealand, but you know, the last year and a half we've had in the UK and around the world, you know, being stuck indoors, thank goodness we've had these technologies where we can sit and still have a life. But that's not what our bodies and brains were designed for, what we evolved to do. We really need to build that back into our lives because we're missing out on something important about what our bodies and minds are for if we don't.
And the link between those two, new research suggesting the connection between exercise and the brain going deeper than we might think.
The absence of exercise can be seen, do you think, in falling IQs and the rise in mental illness?
It's possible. I mean, there's clearly a lot of things going on in our lives over the last, 50 years or something. But it's definitely true for a long time, IQs, well, for as long as we've been measuring IQs, those population scores have been rising all over the world. And then in recent years, it sort of started to level off and then start to dip off slightly. And you know, obviously there's other things going on other than our sedentary lifestyles, but there's also research that looks at the individual level, and people who spend more time sedentary have cognitive decline earlier and faster than people who are more active. So there's some things going on, and we know very well that physical activity, when we move our bodies, it makes our brain invest in architecture. So we add new brain cells, it adds new blood vessels, it adds new wiring. Everything just works better when you're physically active. So yeah, we've known that for a really long time. And there's been a lot of people making the link between sedentary behavior and anxiety and depression as well. And you know, it's not too far-fetched to think that that may be playing into the sort of epidemic levels we've seen, especially in young people who are not moving anywhere near as much as they used to.
And you can't solve the problem of being mostly sedentary, which a lot of us try to do, by going for broke in patches, you know, in your lunchtime spin class, you say. We've got to rethink the whole attitude towards moving.
Yes, because I think what we've got in our heads, that what movement's all about, is that it's exercise. And, you know, you sit and you sit and you sit, and then you do some exercise and then you sit again. But there's some really interesting studies that look at, decline in brain function over time. And it seems to correlate with the amount of time you spend sedentary, regardless of whether you do high intensity exercise or activity during the day. So it's more about little and often rather than just doing one little burst in the day, or even thinking, oh, I should do three spin classes, or I should do three lots of running in the day, or whatever. It's not about getting more exercise. It's about breaking up the sitting by moving, even if that just means going downstairs, putting the kettle on, whether that means sitting not at your desk but on the floor, because then you're not leaning and slouching, you're using your core muscles. You know, there's lots of ways of moving that aren't necessarily exercise, and I think that's a really important thing to get out there. It doesn't have to hurt, it doesn't have to make you sweaty, it's just not sitting.
Yes, and we've heard a version of this, but you really underscore it in this book, and you've got a lot of science to cite. You know, we can exercise and our hippocampus expands, our brain's main memory bank. But then if we don't keep moving, the brain, if we think of it like a hard drive, deletes the new files we aren't using, Caroline.
Well, it's about capacity. So yeah, when we're moving around, and this is pretty well established now, and sort of, you know, that we know that physical activity adds capacity to the brain. That, yeah, if that capacity isn't used, the brain is very much a use it or lose it organ. It's a bit like, you know, if you do lots of press-ups every day, you're going to get strong arms. If you stop doing that, your muscle is going to break down a little bit. Exactly the same thing happens with the brain. If you don't use it, then why would the brain keep investing in new capacity? Because it's very expensive to run in terms of how much energy it takes to run a brain. You know, they're quite complicated bits of kit.
Caroline Williams is talking to us, the author of Move, The New Science of Body Over Mind. And we don't just do our thinking in our heads, which is the upshot of what you found, really. Can we talk about walking, which a lot of people do? We're told a brisk pace is necessary. We even heard on this show from a neuroscience professor in Dublin, actually, that 22 minutes of brisk walking is ideal for your brain. But you offer a kind of two-speed alternative in your book.
Yes, so the brisk walking, that's really interesting, because there's some research by this great character, it's called Dick Green, in New Mexico. And what he has found is that we sort of almost have these pressure pads in our feet. So as we move forward and we strike our feet onto the ground, whether that's walking or running, that has an effect on the blood in our blood vessels. And that sort of sets up waves of sort of turbulence, if you like. And at the other end of our body, in our heart, that is also, you know, pumping blood. And he's found that at this sort of sweet spot of 120 steps per minute, our heart rate synchronizes with our footfall in such a way that it boosts blood flow to the brain. So this is quite a fast pace, 120 minutes, you know, two steps a second, you're really going for it. He speculates that maybe this accounts for the good feelings you get when you're exercising. So when you're moving forward at a pace, you're getting a bit more of a shoosh to the blood to the brain, you're getting all the oxygen, you're getting the glucose, you're getting all the stuff that you need to run your brain well. And that can be a really good way to get your brain sort of firing on all cylinders. So if you have a big meeting or something, going out for a brisk walk, two steps a second is probably a really good thing to do. It's not easy to keep it up for too long, but yeah, it definitely seems to be this kind of weird sweet spot as well. And there's a nice tie-in with dance as well, that at 120 beats per minute is the rhythm at which humans tap along most accurately in the lab, and it's sort of the speed at which most people fall into a rhythm if they walk at their own pace.
Yes, and I'll get back to the dance. Charles Darwin had a thinking path that he trotted along and had his good ideas on, and we could all manage a version of a thinking path. What is the blessing then of the meander? What's the advantage of the slow walk?
Historical figures through time have talked about walking and thinking and meandering over the hills and having the best ideas. And Darwin was a classic case. So he came back from the voyages of the Beagle. He got onto shore. He basically almost immediately wrote down a sketch of the Tree of Life. It's a really lovely sketch. You can find it online. He's on a little tree. And then he wrote above, "I think, dot, dot, dot." And then it was a good 5 years before he managed to do anything really with that, partly because he was in London, it was busy, it was noisy, he had this young family that were just sort of outside his study the whole time. And so he moved away, he moved to the countryside and built this thinking path, which is a quarter of a mile path through his lovely grounds. If you're ever in the UK, you can visit it, it's in Kent. And you can wander along this path, along the side of a meadow, and then it sort of loops back through some woodland. And he just went round and round that path sort of four or five times a day at least, thinking. And it's here that he had the headspace to come up with the theory of evolution. And the really interesting thing that we know about walking at a pace, or actually doing anything active at a pace that feels easy to you, does something to the brain in that it makes the brain cast widely for ideas. It's the bit of brain behind the forehead called the prefrontal cortex. And this narrows down our thoughts and our ideas. It's sort of it's responsible for impulse control. It basically just keeps you sensible and grown up and on the right path. But when you're moving forward at a pace that's easy, activity in this region of the brain gets sort of naturally turned down for a little bit. And that frees your mind up to, you know, put things together without your prefrontal cortex jumping in and saying, no, 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 that won't work. So it's kind of an easy way to get into the right state for ideas and for bringing information together in ways that, you know, maybe you haven't thought of before. And because every brain is unique, maybe nobody else has thought of before as well. So Darwin had the right idea. And it's kind of, we have to all, I think, remind ourselves that that counts as work, because no one would have, you know, had a go at Darwin and said, "You lazy tyke, you know, go back into your office and carry on writing." You know, he was doing musing. And I think we need to give ourselves permission to do the same, even if it feels a little bit like skiving sometimes.
Sit down and stay down and work on evolution. No.
Yes. Right.
There's another aspect to this, which is moving lightly on your feet, lifting mood. Mm-hmm. Easier said than done if you've got a lot of weight on, I suppose. But that was an interesting aspect of what you wrote about.
Yes. You know, we have this sort of built-in idea that things that are up are good and things that are down and heavy are bad. And so there have been some studies done where people have been skipping around lightly on their feet, and they get them to do various mental tasks afterwards. And people think happier, more positive thoughts when they are moving lightly on their feet. So, yeah, even if you don't feel like it, a little light skip around might do wonders. I actually did a natural movement workshop a couple of weekends ago, and the guy who was leading it said, "I don't have any evidence for this, but I really do think that skipping makes you happy." And I said, actually, I can tell you categorically, skipping does make you happy. So, yes, absolutely. It's science. So you might look silly, but go for it anyway.
Speaking of that, I've never been able to identify the endorphins and the endocannabinoids that come with walking or running. And you say you need to be really breathless, but, you know, I get breathless, but I feel pleased. That's about all, that I've actually done it and ticked it off ticked it off for the day. I mean, how do you get the runners high or the dancers high or the skippers high?
Well, I'm not much of a runner, I have to say. I've been very keen to believe that walking does everything that running does. You just have to do it for a bit longer. And there is some research that backs that up. You know, finding what makes you feel good and doing that, I think, is a really important thing.
We're talking with Caroline Williams, the author of Move. We are exhorted to remember, I think futilely in most cases, the names of many different, you know, acids and proteins and hormones and such these days, which may enhance health. But Caroline, at the risk of in one ear and out the other, can you tell us what osteocalcin does, because it seems to be vital?
Yes, osteocalcin is a really interesting one, because who knew that your bones were talking to your brain? But that's exactly what they're doing. So we think of our bones as being sort of dry white sticks that hold us up and move us around, but they're sort of their living organs, and they're being built up when we put more demands on them, working against gravity, whether that's lifting weights or just moving our body weight around. And they break down bone if we're not putting weight on them. So people who are on bed rest, astronauts when they come back from microgravity, lose bone mass. But we do know now that when the bone is building up, a hormone is released from the bone into the blood. It's called osteocalcin. And it travels in the blood to the brain, where it connects with the hippocampus, which is that bit of the brain, again, involved in memory in general, spatial memory in particular, and it enhances memory. So there's been a lot of research done on this in mice, and a little bit in humans. Again, been a little bit scuppered by the old pandemic, but there are some signs that the more osteocalcin you have in your blood, the better your memory, and the slower the cognitive decline. It's also linked to anxiety. So these mice who don't have any osteocalcin in their blood, they sort of tend to hide in the corner of their cages, and they don't want to explore. And this ties in really nicely with research that shows strength building reduces anxiety, and it's just basically good for the brain in many, many, many ways. And so there's this little hormone that's kind of coming from our bones when we tax them. When we're sitting down, that's not happening so much. So we really need to, this is just another reason really why we need to get up and move.
And that strength training has more benefit, doesn't it, than improvements in cardiovascular fitness in that respect?
Yes. So there's been studies done on the effects of strength training on anxiety, depression, and this thing that psychologists call global self-efficacy, which is basically a way of saying, do you feel like you can handle life? And they all improve with weight training, regardless of whether there's any changes in cardio fitness. So it's not about just endorphins and getting the blood pumping. There's something going on just by building up strength. You get a better sense that you can handle life, which is really important, I think, given that so many kids and adults as well are a lot weaker than we used to be, because we don't have to do weight bearing exercise as much as we used to. That's a really important thing that I think we need to build back into life as well.
And in your book, you cite a study of teenage girls who boosted their strength and then felt much more confident about their general effectiveness in life. You know, physical strength, you say, is linked to higher self-esteem and a feeling of being capable. But, and I suppose we've always known that, but we've kind of associated it perhaps with being prepossessing and impressive to look at. But it's more than that. It's not how you look. It's actually inside changing how you feel.
Yes, and some of the studies have found that even before you see changes in muscle that you can see on the outside or measure, that these changes in the way you feel show up. So it isn't about getting bulging muscles. It isn't about knowing that you can fight if you have to. There's something more going on. And so there's a really interesting idea that kind of goes back into sort of embodied cognition. And there's a philosopher, neuroscientist called Antonio Damasio, who talks about how part of the way we understand ourself, how we get a sense of self, is from these unconscious messages that are coming from our body to our brain that sort of constantly updating us about the state of the equipment, basically. So it's sort of, he describes it as background feelings, which I kind of feel like is a bit like background music when you're watching a movie. So sometimes, you know, there's sounds that make you feel slightly on edge and you can't quite work out why. And, you know, sometimes there's pumping music and you feel really good. These similar sort of ideas are going on with the body. So if the body is strong, the background messaging is, that's fine, you can relax. And if it isn't, then maybe there's more to be anxious about. And so you may have this underlying sense of unease without really knowing why. And so maybe improving strength can really change the tone of that conversation for the better, without you having to think about it consciously and sort of talk yourself out of being stressed and worried and anxious.
And the good news, as you say, is that although there is, in many people, one suspects a kind of shrug of the shoulders at the daunting, you know, prospect of fitting a lot of exercise into their lives, you can do really simple stuff, you say in your book. You can sit on the floor, as you mentioned. Now, can you expand on why that is a good idea?
Yeah, so there are populations of people around the world who live a lot longer than other people. And one of the things they do lots of things very well. They have good diets. They have a lot of social contact. They have lots of good ideas. But one of the things they tend to do is that they sit on the floor quite a lot. They have low tables. They squat to rest rather than sitting down. And so one of the things that happens if you sit on the floor is inevitably you're going to have to get up again. And every time you do that, you're pushing your entire body weight with your legs. And that can't fail to strengthen them. And, you know, the practice of getting up and down improves balance. So there's many reasons why sitting on the floor is a good thing. It's good for your mobility as well. So, yeah, I've been doing that quite a lot. That's probably my biggest change, is that when I get a bit bored and fidgety, I'll sort of take my laptop somewhere else, sit on the floor and fidget there instead. So that's a really simple thing you can do in your life, you know, but it really could be anything, even just not sitting lolling back against your chair, just sitting up and engaging the core is better than what we're mostly doing. So there's very simple ways you can do, just even getting up, walking up down the stairs, walking up again. It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to hurt. Yeah, you can just build it in very, very easily.
Speaking of engaging the core, you can do it in interesting ways. And you mention laughter in your book, like belly laughs, as they call them. Strengthening the core. Does that work if you just kind of pretend to laugh?
Yes, well, there's this thing that sounds possibly even more awful for the sort of introvert among people, that it sounds even more awful than the kind of dance thing that I did. But it's called laughter yoga, where you basically go along and you pretend to be laughing. You use all the same muscles you would do if you were actually cracking up. And laughter has been shown to be a better core workout than crunches or anything else. So ideally have some really funny friends and spend time with them. But if not, laughter yoga has been shown to be, you know, good for the core, and it makes people feel happier as well.
You talked about dancing, and of course we know about the importance of community in life, and I don't think we have to flesh that out much, because it's so obvious that we need friends. And you talked about dancing or walking both at 120 beats per minute. What about, because it's that sweet spot between the body and the brain, what about dancing alone, though? There is a benefit from that as well.
Yes. If you don't have anyone to dance with, if you're on your own, dancing to music that's been made by another human at this particular beat, you're moving your body to the noises that they're making by moving their bodies. And there's a very similar sensation. You sort of feel like you're joining in with the band, is what one neuroscientist said to me. You know, it's like an invite to join in with the band. And so you can feel part of something bigger than yourself by dancing along to music totally alone. So you can really can dance like nobody's watching, because nobody is, and it can still feel really good.
And there are certain songs you can find online that move along at 120 beats a minute, like Don't Stop Till You Get Enough and I Want to Dance with Somebody and all those. It's interesting. The experiments with toddlers in your book, Caroline, that show not to use language too fanciful, but the experiments that show when we dance, we are more at one with the universe, or at least those around us. That is all fascinating if it's true, even from a really early age.
Yeah, it's really sweet. And I actually wrote an article years ago about toddlers are a lot nicer than you think they are. They're actually much more likely to help an adult if they, you know, they start noticing very early on and they want to help you. But these kind of experiments, they had adults and they were bouncing the little toddlers on their knees, and they either bounced them in time to the music or they bounced them out of time. And then the experiment afterwards, you know, the adult would sort of pretend to accidentally drop something, and the toddlers were far more likely to pick it up and hand it back to them if they'd been bounced in time than if they'd been bounced out of time. And which is just really adorable. There are actually some videos online of children, these kind of experiments with children, and they're just so cute. But it's true of adults as well. So there's been experiments done where people tap along in time together, and then they play games where they sort of have to share, or, you know, they can either sort of stitch each other up or they can share nicely. And we're much more likely to cooperate with each other if we've been moving in time beforehand. So this one great researcher that I spoke to, Peter Giannata, he's working on what he calls the groove enhancement machine, which he thinks you can take along to, you know, maybe big international meetings and get the delegates to kind of tap along together before they have to have these difficult conversations, and maybe people will work together a little bit better.
Yes, no, I was reading about the groove enhancement machine in your book, and it seems to work best with the song Superstition by Stevie Wonder, doesn't it?
Well, that was an experiment they did to try and find out what the nature of the groove was. So this term, you know, was sort of locked away in the 60s until Peter Giannata brought it out and used it to describe that feeling of the music being so irresistible that you can't help moving your body to it. And so he got a load of people together and he played them various kinds of music and said, you know, tell me which one you want to move to. Tell me which you consider most groovy. And yeah, out of all the pieces of music, 100-odd pieces of music, Superstition came out absolutely top. It's scientifically proven that you cannot not move to it.
So at the G20, it should be compulsory. You know, whenever leaders meet, and this sounds like a joke, but in fact, it might work quite well. Or whenever, you know, politicians get into a room, any group of people trying to decide something important, there should be compulsory dancing.
Compulsory superstition dancing, yes. I don't know whether I'd want to see that meeting. Your leader's a bit cooler than ours, so she might do well.
But before, yeah, that's right. I can think of some I'd seen and not watch. Before we leave dancing, it's any sort of dancing. You don't have to, as you say, you don't have to look good, but you don't even have to move much, do you?
No, I mean, it's kind of, yeah, just, well, Giannata, Peter Giannata, who's the groove enhancement machine man, he says, no, I don't really dance, but, you know, I can totally have these groovy experiences just listening to music. So maybe just move your head, you bob your head, tap your feet. You know, it's enough just to move your body to the music, and then you just feel better. You feel part of something more profound than just you sitting in your house being otherwise a bit bored. So, wow. Yeah.
Breathing. We get so much advice on breathing. And I mean, we're told how to breathe properly, but many of us don't do it, do we, except in fits and starts. But we might pay it more attention if we knew that breathing through your nose significantly increases reaction time, you've written, Caroline. And we think avoiding that car crash on the road. Wow. I mean, it's just one study, but you do give it credence.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's basically we're talking milliseconds. So in terms of the experiments, you have people pressing a button and, you know, seeing if they can react something fast. And it is in milliseconds. But yeah, I mean, I do make the point in the book that if we're talking milliseconds, that can be the sort of the difference between jumping out of the way of a speeding car or not. Maybe obviously more work needs to be done on that. But breathing through your nose does have this unique way of tying in a lot of brain activity that seems to be a basic way that the brain works by tying all this information together on the same wavelength. So the yogis have been banging on about this for ages, but the research does seem to be backing it up.
I can't go through all the fascinating aspects of breathing in your book, breathing fast and breathing slow, if you like. But, for example, 6 breaths per minute through your nose is generally optimal.
Yes, there's another one of these sort of physiological sweet spots, if you like. So it's the speed of breathing where people, if you get them to breathe at different rates, 6 breaths per minute is where people will say, yeah, that's the most relaxing. That's when I felt the best. It's also, intriguingly, when studies have been done of things like chanting, reciting the rosary in Latin, and various sort of spiritual practices, they tend to make the breath go to this 6 breaths per minute, which might be why, you know, we figured this out a long time ago, that maybe that's why these practices are so calming and make you feel at one with the world. We also know that it's the rate at which you get the most oxygen into your lungs. It activates the vagus nerve, which is sort of the calm down bit of the nervous system. So there's a lot of reasons why trying to breathe at 6 breaths per minute, when you remember, obviously not all the time because it's impossible, but that could be, that's a really easy way of just sort of resetting to a place of calm.
Move, the new science of body over mind, Caroline Williams. Look, there's too much to ask you, but posture is everything, as the old saying goes, and I'm sure there's some truth to it. You spend a lot of time talking about posture and it making us feel better as well as being physically better for us. What's your posture like, though? Because you'd be like me in front of a keyboard for a large part of my life, I think.
Well, since you started talking about posture, I'm very, very good. I'm just sat bolt upright.
Right. Oh,
I'm absolutely fine. But yeah, it's one of those things that everyone's mother's always said, isn't they? Sit up straight. And it's really important, it turns out. An upright posture makes you feel better. And there's some really, really interesting new research that offers a potentially different mechanism, which is that there seems to be neural pathways between the adrenal glands, which are the first line of the stress response, and they sort of sit on top of our kidneys and pump out adrenaline and other things. And there are direct neural connections back to the brain. And when you trace those connections back, they turn up in the bit of the brain that's to do with voluntary movement. And specifically, the part of the brain that controls movements of the core. And so this is a really interesting new bit of information that's, you know, very, very early days, but it does suggest that there may be something about bracing your core that helps to stand down the stress response and make you feel a little bit more capable. You know, the good thing about being humans is that you can know that and then choose to put yourself in a different position. And maybe that could make you feel better in ways, because most things that are to do with stress control are, you know, variations of you're stressed, think your way out of it. So the idea of using your core as a way to use your body as a tool to get the same effect kind of really appeals to me, because sometimes you can't think yourself out of being stressed. Sometimes something else can happen. So that, and it also explains why things like Pilates and yoga and Tai Chi and lots of other things that involve core, paddleboarding is another thing, are so calming. Maybe it's because the core is activated and working, and that sends a message to your body that you're in control, everything's fine, and everything can calm down.
Yeah.
So there's lots of interesting stuff to kind of delve into there.
There's lots of interesting stuff we won't be delving into in your books. The benefits of stretching, exposure to cold water, releasing cold shock proteins into the blood. I have to ask you about this because you stopped me in my tracks when you cited research showing that hypermobile people, which is me actually, and 20% of the human race are more prone to anxiety. One study found that 70% of hypermobile patients had an anxiety disorder of some kind, compared with 22% of healthy volunteers. And another estimated that anxiety and panic disorders 16 times more common in people who have hypermobile joints. Wow.
Yes. And it's one of those very strange things. I mean, it was noted sort of hundreds of years ago, or over 100 years ago, that people with hypermobile joints were more prone to anxiety, or whatever they called anxiety when it was at less PC times. But that sort of got forgotten, and it's just being picked up now by a group of researchers in the University of Sussex. And they are looking into why that might be. And there's some really interesting ideas about how we have this implicit sense of where our body is in space, and maybe that if your joints are looser, you have a less kind of accurate grasp on that, and maybe that affects the sense of self somehow. Also, there's another thing called postural tachycardia, which is that when people with hypermobile joints, who also tend to have looser collagen elsewhere, which is sort of surrounding blood vessels and basically everywhere in the body, when they stand up, what would normally happen is that your blood vessels constrict so that your blood doesn't pool in your legs and it goes, you know, and then you get a crash in blood pressure. But if your blood vessels are more stretchy, that doesn't happen, or at least not so efficiently, and people feel faint and have to sit down again. And so maybe what's happening in anxiety is that when this happens, when somebody moves around, the heart has to compensate by beating faster. And it's possible that that's being then interpreted as anxiety. So there's kind of all kinds of body brain stuff going on that may be different in people with hypermobile joints and looser collagen, but that's all to be explored further. But there's some really interesting stuff going on there.
That is so fascinating. Look, I'll let you go. It's lovely of you to give us so much time. But basically, from your book, the need, I've inferred, the need to take the mind, often the troubled mind, into the body, let the moving body be your therapist in a way, and defy gravity, whatever you do in exercise. You know, it's like lifting your life up through your body, resisting what drags you down, isn't it? It seems psychosomatic and all in the head, but in fact it's such a mixture of head and body.
I mean the whole thing came from this realization one day that thinking as if of your brain as if it's not attached to the rest of you is a really strange way to think of it. I mean, clearly we are animals and it's all part of the same system, and so trying to think without moving doesn't really make any sense. And it's so obvious when you think about it. You know, why is it that you feel better after a walk, or calmer after a yoga session, or whatever?
Yeah.
And there's many, many reasons why. So yes, I would encourage people to not only read the book, but yes, get out and do some movement for sure.
I'll let you do that very thing. Congratulations on the book, and thank you very much for giving us your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Caroline Williams, Move, the New Science of Body Over Mind.